This is the Be One Change One podcast, where our mission is to help listeners define values, practice integrity, and inspire change.
Our vision is to mentor men and empower them to achieve more by taking responsibility for shaping their own lives.
He's Cass, an evolving man who has been shaped by adversity and continues to grow through his imperfections.
And he's Roscoe, an imperfect work in progress that tries to suck less every day.
Between us, we have over 40 years of Air Force fighter pilot experience with countless hours as trainers, instructors, and mentors.
Join us and learn to take responsibility for your own life as we dive into subjects from leadership to resilience to vulnerability.
Be the one who changes their course. Be decisive, driven, and purposeful. Set the example for others. Lead. We wish we'd had this show when we were younger men.
Be the one.
So, actually, Katie came up with the idea the other day to, hey, you got Veterans Day coming up. What a nice idea it would be to release something on Veterans Day. You and I are both veterans. That's well documented. So, decided through a little bit of gnashing of teeth to do fighter pilot traditions and highlight some of those cool things. There are going to be some traditions, obviously, that we won't talk about. We can't let every cat out of the bag.
Yeah.
And to be honest, man, since you and I were in the game, some of those traditions have changed.
Yeah, a lot of them have probably. I mean, they were starting to when I was getting out. It was a little bit different down for us in the 425th because we were kind of carved out of that a little bit, you know, but I'm sure some of the stuff has changed.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but your video just cut out.
Yeah. Yours did a second ago too. It's definitely, it's interesting, man. I mean, when you just think about when you started in the Air Force and, but you know, it's evolutionary too. Cause I remember when I was a young punk, a young lieutenant at Kunsan, which was my first operational assignment in Korea, we were sitting at the O Club on a Friday night having drinks. And we were talking to the vice wing commander who had been a punk there in F4s in the 70s. And he told us a story about them getting drunk one Friday night, like four or five of the punks, going over to command post, knocking on the door, saying they needed a key for the squadron or something. And then basically going into command post, duct taping all the airmen to their chairs, calling the wing commander and saying, "We own your command post." And that's like, they could get away with that in the 70s, right? Like if you did that now, you'd be in Leavenworth for the rest of your life. But, you know, so yeah. I think some of it's an evolution. Same guy also was flying so low one time that he clipped a power line with the tail of his F4 and he got grounded for 2 weeks.
Not a tradition.
Nope.
That's a one-off.
Not a tradition. But he got grounded for 2 weeks for doing that, man. You would never fly another day in the Air Force if you did something like that now. So, I mean, you know, I think some of those things are just a little evolutionary.
The times change, man. Yeah. And you know, when you and I were growing up in the Air Force and going through kind of our fledgling stages, and you hit a good point there. And I want to rewind to some of the things you were saying. You mentioned a word in there twice and you said punk. So explain to us what a punk is in the world you came from.
When you're a young lieutenant right out of the B course at your first operational assignment, you're in the LPA, which is the Lieutenant's Protection Association. And then you're considered a punk. Everybody calls you a punk because you're just a young pup trying to find his voice still.
Various communities have different ways to communicate kind of the same thing. You got FNGs, which is fucking new guys.
Yeah.
FNG. Shit pants was always my favorite. Shit pants, as in you're wearing diapers, you're a baby. Typically, your first assignment lieutenants, young guys probably haven't been named yet, you know, those kinds of dudes.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you're always FNG until you get named. So,
yeah. And it's great. You know, Friday, everybody wears their call sign name tags. Mm-hmm. And you know, that kind of leans in a little bit to, let's explain a little bit about that. Just as a kind of a sidebar, but the tradition of on Fridays, fighter pilots wearing their call sign name tag. So not your first name, last name, it's your call sign only with your wings and squadron colors or squadron patches or whatever. Whereas every other day of the week you wear, you know, you might have a name tag that says Cass Cooper or Jason Cooper or my name's Paul White or Roscoe White. But typically we're not wearing our call signs during the week. on Fridays, you wear a tag that only has your call sign. So it would just say Cass in big bold letters, or Roscoe in big bold letters, which is why First Name Friday is so significant, because you can't just glance down at a guy's name tag and get his first name.
And
you
get his first name.
Kind of know your squatter mates a little bit.
You have to actually know people.
Yeah. You know, God forbid you have to talk to an individual. First name,
right? Especially for me.
That's great. Well, I guess chronological order, we can hop around, we can do whatever, but, you know, going all the way back to, you've told the story very well on how you got into the Air Force and how much of an uphill climb it was for you to get to UPT and those kinds of things. So let's go all the way back to those days and talk about maybe some of those very first traditions. You know, you're wearing your flight suit and you're doing the thing, talking into a mask, and then what?
Yeah, well, it's funny, right? Because you're wearing a flight suit, and I didn't know it at pilot training, but, you know, you got the, for lack of a better term, the penis pouch on a flight suit. So all the flight suits on the left leg, for the listeners out there, had a little flip over pouch that had a snap on it. And it was supposed to hold, I guess,
your parachute knife.
Your parachute knife, you know, if you're in the heavy community.
I've got one in my Can-Am in the door bag. It's a switchblade, man, and it is sharp as hell. It's awesome.
Yeah, but we didn't, with a G-suit on, you can't have anything down there. So, like, one of the first things that you would always do when you get new flight suits is take those off, right? Because that was shit when you wanted to be a fighter guy, and then there's a little flap on the left side of your shoulder. You have a spot to put pens and pencils, and there's a little flap that goes over it. We'd always cut that off because you want to be able to get access to it. You don't want to be messing around with it. You don't have time for that kind of stuff. So that was one of the things, you know, but the first.
So hold up.
Yeah.
You know, I like to tell stories, right? So there I was. All right. We took a hop from Pensacola up to Seymour Johnson. You know, we had all just gotten our drop. We all got Strike Eagles, and it's going to be awesome. We want to go up there and kind of meet some of the bros that we're going to see here in just a couple of months when we go to Strike Eagle training. So we take a Air Force T1 up there. There's, I don't know, two or three of us in the back end of this thing. We fly up there, and we're getting a tour of one of the FTU squadrons, the B course, the basic course squadrons that we're going to be in here in just a couple of months. And on the wall is one of those penis pouches that they had ripped off of a student just like me. They ripped it off and tacked it up to the wall in the bar and says, "Don't be a bitch. We're fighter pilots." And I was like, "Oh, this is awesome." Right.
Yeah,
of course,
it,
we had gotten the gouge and we had all cut ours off by then. But so don't be a bitch and wear your penis pouch.
That's right. But probably the first tradition that kind of struck me at pilot training was the dunk tank, right? So on your very first solo, the very first time you get to solo an aircraft, a United States Air Force aircraft by yourself, and you don't do anything really but beat up the pattern for the most part. But the first time you solo, when you land, you come back, you taxi in, you have a bunch of your classmates out there that are in that pilot training class with you and a couple of VIPs, the instructors, and they get your gear off of you. And the dunk tank in, so it was like, I think I soloed in February in Wichita Falls,
Texas. Oh, so that water's nice and warm. Yeah,
and it is just literally like, it's just a big round, it's like a drinking.
It's like a cattle trough.
Yeah, it's a cattle trough or something like that, right? And it's just, it's nasty, and it was freezing cold. I don't think my balls descended for like 2 weeks because they were.
How many guys are taking a piss in that thing, you think?
Yeah, you know, and they grab you on each arm, one on each leg, heave-ho, and throw you right into it, so. That was a pretty cool tradition for the solo.
Is this the Air Force condoning hazing of students?
Yeah, it's not really hazing. It's just
It's brotherly love, man. Welcome to the brotherhood.
Well, but see, that those are the things that I think in a lot of ways build, you know, esprit de corps. And it's like, you know, it's you do all this work and all this prep for so long to get ready to go to pilot training, and then you start flying. And then they finally give you the keys to the car. And I think it's a cool way to just, you know, celebrate that moment for guys.
And yeah, 100%. Man. Unique, and you know.
You know,
that brings up a good point, dude. I remember taxiing out. I was at Mountain Home and I'd been there a couple of years. I mean, I had, I don't know, 500-600 hours of flying time. And I remember taxiing out, talking to this guy in the front seat. And I'm like, dude, just take a second and let's just take this in for a minute, man.
Yeah.
It's a benign sortie, right? It's just a training sortie. I was like, who the hell thought it was a great idea to give us the keys to an F-15? Holy, are you kidding me?
Yeah, to a $40 million aircraft.
Yeah. Here you go. Just, you know, Cass, just go beat up the pattern. Have fun. We're going to throw you in a cattle trough when you get back.
Yeah, it was awesome, man. So that was probably the first one. And then after that, it's your dollar ride. So,
yeah.
For the listeners, well, you want to talk about dollar rides or you want me to?
Well, yeah. So I think it's worth noting here that the two different training tracks that you and I went on had maybe some differences and stuff. Like we didn't do the dunk tank down at the Wizzo training when we got our Wizzo wings and everything, but we did do the dollar rides, and that was kind of the, you know, that was the checkout ride. That was, that was your first real checked out. You are done with the program, man. You're one of us now, kind of thing. And the first guy that we go up with at that point, like your first ride as one of the bros, that was the dollar ride.
Yeah, and that was the same way in the F-16 RTU, but it was your first solo. So because your first couple of rides in the B course for the F-16 is in the D model, which is a 2-seater. You got the IP in the trunk.
Yeah,
and then you got the student up front. And then you take them through, I want to say it's like maybe four or five rides of what we call TR, which is just learning how to fly the airplane and doing instruments and stuff like that. And then boom, they're on their first solo. And now they've got an IP in another jet that's chasing them, but they're by themselves in an F-16. And that was their dollar ride. And so,
we did a crew solo where it was, so when we go to the B course, we're paired up, pilot and Wizzos are paired up. And we go through, we would go all the way through the air to air phase as a pair, and then they would shuffle the deck a little bit. So you kind of got a new pairing when you got to the air to surface phase about halfway through or so. And on my crew solo, me and the guy, we ended up getting stationed together at Mountain Home, me and the pilot dude, Dirty, shout out to Dirty. He's down in Tucson right now, but, so we're on landing rollout. Like it was pretty epic, man. You know, you get to go up and you're kind of on your own for a little bit and you just kind of go cold mic for a little while and take it all in for just a second, you know, but we're on landing rollout and we're still at, you know, 13 AOA, like aero braking down the runway. And one of the things that one of the duties that I was supposed to do was part of the shutdown or the after landing checklist was go to the bit page and run a very particular bit on a set of equipment. That's a built-in test. And it's just to make sure that piece of equipment is good to go. No faults, whatever that we need to report to maintenance. Well, at that time in the Strike Eagle, the way that the page was mecked was when the button that said menu under it also said auto bit when you got to the menu. So you would push the menu, wait a second, it would go to the page, and then you would push auto bit. And what auto bit does is it bits all the
everything,
systems.
Everything in the
instead of doing just this one particular system, it did all the systems. And so Roscoe's dumbass, we're on landing rollout, still nose up, rolling out on two wheels. I reach up and hit menu and nothing happened. And I went and bam, hit the button again. And right when I did it, it flipped to the page. Over. So I ran an auto bit. And so we're like on landing rollout with no systems working. The whole cockpit goes dark and we're like, oh shit. Okay. Lesson learned.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So that was my dollar ride.
Yeah. And then it's tradition, at least in the Viper community, it was tradition on dollar rides. You would always talk to your instructor the day before, and then they would tell you like what their favorite adult beverage was. And then you'd either get them a handle of that or a six pack or whatever the case was, whatever they wanted as kind of payment for taking you up on your first solo. Yeah.
It's good to be an IP, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then, so you got your dollar ride and you're accepted as one of the bros. You're still a shit pants. You still don't know anything. FNG punk shit pants, whatever you put on it.
Probably the next big one was just when you graduate pilot training, the night you get your wings, you know, so you've been running around a first lieutenant and, you know, you've just got a name badge on, but there ain't nothing on it. And everybody else around you, all the instructors, everybody else has wings.
Cool little Air Force symbol on it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and you finally get to graduation and they tack your wings on you. So. That was a really cool ceremony and moment. Obviously, it's a lot of work. You know, it's a year with, for me, in that year, 10 check rides, 5 in each airframe, the T5 and the T37, and then 5 in the T38, you know, and just constantly being evaluated and tested and stuff like that.
Hey, well, let me ask you this, man. In the order of, I don't know, I guess most fulfilling and maybe rewarding goes in there, but... You know, you're a well-educated man, as am I. been, you know, got a lot of pieces of paper that said that I paid some people to get smart. And then you go through something like flight school, which I had heard some people describe that as the equivalent of getting a master's degree in about a year.
Yeah.
How would you rank those, you know, getting your master's degree, going across the stage and getting your diploma for your master's degree versus getting your wings that day?
Yeah, no, it's by far, far and above any kind of educational certificate or degree program that I've finished in my life. Getting my master's degree was nothing compared to graduating from pilot training or graduating from weapons school. So
I concur 100%.
Yeah. And it was the same thing when I went to weapons school, you know, all the WUGs, the guys that are in the weapons upgrade, you don't get to wear anything on your left shoulder the whole time you're there. Either you don't wear a patch on your left shoulder the
blank
entire
space,
time you're
there,
you know? So, which is just a constant reminder of what you're there striving towards. But the traditional piece that I was getting at though, from pilot training is they pin those wings on you. And then that night, at the bar, everybody breaks their wings.
That's something we didn't do.
Yeah. Cause
at least I don't remember it. Cause I was on another planet that night.
The folklore is that, you know, you're never supposed to fly with the wings that you actually get in pilot training. And by breaking them, those are the only pair of wings that you ever break in your life. Right. So it's supposed to like kind of keep you safe, keep you out of trouble. And then those wings are never supposed to be brought back together until you pass. And then the tradition is that like when you pass, maybe at your funeral or whatever, somebody can bring those two pieces back together and throw them in the whatever you're in, the casket or the urn or whatever, you know, and then that's supposed to give you good luck in the next life. So I remember breaking
that's
wings.
Pretty cool, man. Do you still have yours?
I do. Yep. I sure do. I still have both pieces. So yeah.
Well, make sure those are listed out somewhere where we can go and find them when you finally do kick the bucket, you old turd.
Yeah. Some guys did really cool things with theirs. Like there were a couple of wives that like had the one half made into like a bracelet that they would wear and stuff like that. It was kind of cool. So,
yeah, some of that's pretty cool. Yeah, man. I honestly don't remember doing anything like that. We were obviously, I mean, I went through NAS Pensacola, which I mean, as far as assignments wise, that was a pretty awesome place to be. I was down there when Katrina hit and it was funny. Like a few weeks before Katrina, there was a hurricane that came through and we evacuated for that. I can't remember the name of it now. Dennis, maybe. Anyways, fast forward into August that year and Katrina hits and we didn't evacuate for Katrina. We just sat there and, you know, we hunkered down. They didn't evacuate the base or anything. So then like, I don't know, 5 days later or so, we get back to where we're going to go start flying. And we were in T6 phase at that point, prop plane, turboprop, prop plane, tandem seating and whatnot. So this one dude grabs me and says, "Hey man, you're up for a VFR cross country. Let's go to Lake Charles." Okay. Dude, Lake Charles was underwater.
Right? Yeah. Go see the damage.
So anyways, we made sure we had enough gas and everything. We just wanted to go cruise the coast at like 1,000 feet and see what was up.
Yeah.
And flying from Pensacola to just west of like Baton Rouge, New Orleans area, down to kind of the swamps of Louisiana, and then coming back, man, it was like, I tell everybody, I said, it was like, for as far as you could see, it was like God just took his hand and did that. And trees were wiped out. It was freaking crazy, man.
When I was in pilot training, there was an F5 tornado that hit Oklahoma City south of Oklahoma City. And I was in instrument phase in T-38s and we went up to, what is it, Lawton Airfield? We went up somewhere over there and we're doing instruments and you could just like see the path of the tornado because it was, literally tell exactly where it had gone because you could just see the fucking line of devastation that it left as it
rolled
through the countryside.
Man.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
You know, for the dudes and ladies that are listening that don't, you know, you very rarely get that perspective. You know, if you fly, you know, Southwest or whatever, you can look out the window occasionally, but that's something that I think that we took for granted a lot was just having that different perspective of, you know, the goings on and I mean, the rat race of traffic in Phoenix. But when you took off and headed south, man, it was like, they're just little dots on the ground, you know, and it definitely gives you a different way to approach life in general, I think.
Yeah, well, everything gets smaller the higher you get, that's for sure, right? Like, you see that a lot of the things you may be going through aren't probably too different than what a bunch of people on the ground are probably going through, especially as you cross states and towns and all that stuff, so. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. And you get up, you know, you get up towards, you get up to some of those like, greater than 50K or so, and you can start to see the curvature of the earth,
Yep.
You know, kind of the dark side of the blue on the other end. And it just, yeah. I don't know, man, it makes you think how insignificant we really are sometimes.
Yeah. One tradition I forgot was to, at pilot training was when you finally go above the Mach and you get your little Mach certificate or whatever, which for anybody out there that's listening, like it's so anticlimactic.
You don't even
like,
realize it. It's a number in the HUD changes. Yeah.
You go over the Mach, nothing changes in the aircraft. Nothing. I mean, it gets a little sluggish at times if you get fast enough, but like, no kidding. All that happens is the altimeter does a little boom, boom when you go above the Mach, and that's about it. Yeah. And you're like, really, this is it?
So. If you hang it at 0.99 for, I don't know, a few seconds, you can kind of, you can feel it a little bit, yeah, but if you're just transitory, it's benign. It's like, it's non-existent. Yeah.
It doesn't,
you know, how many years did aviation try to break that barrier only to find out that it really wasn't that big of a deal.
That big of a deal at all.
Yeah. So. And now we got Maverick going Mach 10, you know, I mean, and ejecting and
surviving,
showing
somehow
up and getting a drink of water at a diner in the middle of Vegas somewhere or Nellis. So
awesome.
Yeah. It's like, it's no big deal. So
yeah,
got our wings. I mean, and there's a lot of little stuff that's just mixed in there, but get to the B course, and somewhere through the B course, you got a B course name, which may or may not stick. I'd say probably 90 or greater percent of them don't stick. They're usually something fun or dumb, or, you know, like there was this one cat that came through the F-35 B course the other day or a while back that got named Trix for TR-1X. This person busted their very first ride, which is literally just, if you can take off and put the gear up, put the gear back down and land, you're going to pass.
You're
right.
Pass,
well,
yeah.
Somehow this person did not do those things, I guess, up to a certain standard. So TR-1X, you got named Trix.
That's good.
Anyways. So B course namings are a lot of fun, and there's a lot of tradition. And the one thing I'll say about the naming ceremony, we can't give specifics away, but I'd say they're community specific. And then everyone that I'd ever been to was squadrons had their own like ways and their own traditions. And,
you know, a lot the same, but they have their own way of kind of going about it to a certain extent.
Yeah. They're like different methods and flows. And
yeah. Well, like in Korea, when I was in Korea, we would go down to A-Town, which was basically just this little, like, I don't know, 2-block by 2-block shithole about 10 minutes outside of the base that the Korean mafia ran that had a bunch of bars and restaurants, and security forces would be down there patrolling at night. But when you were at Kunsan, you had your green bean, which was your first sweep. We'd do these sweeps where we'd go down to A-Town and we'd spend like 3 hours going around at 5 different bars. And at every bar, we did a different thing. There was a different song that was sung or something like that. But you have your green bean, you have your naming sweep, which is where you actually get named. And then you had your brown bean, which was your last sweep before you rotated back to the States or to your next assignment. So that's very different than it was, you know, at other squadrons, obviously, because you don't have that same flexibility necessarily when everybody's.
Well, I mean,
like,
and that's
that
unique to that area. But, you know, every time we went to Vegas, and if we were going to do a naming in Vegas, there was always going to be a scavenger hunt attached to that. And by scavenger hunt, I mean, it's like it's events like go participate in a wedding at an Elvis chapel.
Yeah.
You know, have to get that checked off of a list. I mean, there was all manner of different things, you know, get a ride in a limo or something weird like that. So, and then as you show back up, of course, all the bros, we're already at the location, the final destination, if you will. And we've probably had a couple of frosty beverages by then. So then these shit pants start showing up with their list and all of their trophies in tow of completing the scavenger hunt. And whoever did the best gets named first. Whoever did the worst gets named last. And that actually has significance. So all the dudes who are not being named currently they're held in a holding area somewhere. And well, I'll just say that there's a bit of alcohol involved, maybe.
Maybe a little.
Yeah. So if you're at the end of that list, you're going to have a different experience than maybe the people who are at the beginning of that list.
That's right.
And we'll just leave it there. I I was on the back end of the list, and it did not end well. I'll have Katie tell you the story of her trying to show up after my naming, and hilarity ensued. Anyways. Yeah.
What's cool about that though is because they have everybody, and this is true in every squadron that I was ever in. The guys that are getting named are isolated from the rest of the group.
Yes,
you have a mayor that's in charge of running the whole thing, and the larger group of guys in the squadron also get rowdier as the night goes on because drinks have flowed, and so it gets a little harder and harder, and sometimes the names get a little worse and worse. But what's cool is once a guy does get his name, then he immediately becomes part of the group, right? Everybody's high-fiving him.
And he goes back there, and now he can heckle the rest of his bros.
And he's throwing stuff. Yeah, it's awesome. So
yeah, name him shitbag, yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I'll say
There was a guy here. I'm in a Navy base right now, and in the Air Force, I think we take a little – we actually think about the names. And there was a red flag test, right? So when you're giving a guy a name – you always have to ask the question, can he stand up at red flag and be the mission commander and say, hi, my name is, will that name hold up to that test?
Yeah.
So, cool enough. There was like the A-10 Bubbas are pretty, they're pretty liberal with their names. I think there was a guy named Beer Can. I thought that was pretty cool. And then just the other day, I'm sitting here at a Navy base and there's a trash panda and there was a really good story behind that one. So I think in the fighter communities, jets that start with F anyways, we always kind of put that red flag test on it. Can you stand up in front of 500 people and say, hello, my name is Roscoe? Okay, that clearly passes the test,
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I would say about naming bourbon gutter winch may not.
Yeah. Yeah. Or monkey vulva wouldn't be a good one either.
That probably wouldn't pass the test.
No, that wouldn't pass the test at all. some of the other things that I think we can share about namings is, most guys get their names typically when you get named, and there's naming committees. Every squadron I was ever in, there was a naming committee. It's usually, 5 to 8 dudes that get together and, they'll put a big board up in the weapons back in the vault and for a couple of weeks, and they'll have, everybody's FNG last name written down, and everybody comes in and puts whatever they have up on the board. And some of that stuff makes it to the naming committee or makes it to the naming, and some of it doesn't. But typically when you get named, for something that you completely fucked up, right? Like most guys get names. Sometimes it's just funny. It's something that rhymes with some guy's last name. Like we had a guy, Brian, we had a guy, his last name was Tash, and they had Sucka, Poe White, Trailer, Shave Dogs, like all these things because it rhymed with Trailer Tash and all this stuff. Because it all rhymed with Tash. Those were all on the board. So sometimes they're acronyms. But the bottom line is when you get up to deliver a story for a name to try to sell it to the group, there's one rule, and that's that 10% of that story has to be true. So there's a lot of embellishment that goes on.
That's a lot of percent.
And
10% is a lot of percent.
And it sounds, to the outside person, it sounds like, maybe it's mean and it's rough because you're bagging on somebody for something that they screwed up, especially a young guy who just showed up and he's still trying to find his way. They're always going to fuck things up, right? But that's also part of that humble, approachable, credible piece that we talk about, like giving guys those kinds of things where when they have to tell the story to another bro about how they got their call sign and it's slightly embarrassing. Like that's a good way to kind of carry a little bit of humility through the fighter pilot experience, I think. Kind of builds a humility-based culture.
There are some good names out there. There's some good names out there that you can't tell people outside of the bar.
Yeah.
You can't tell them the real story behind that. So you have to make up a complete false identity and a false, like you have to sit down the next day and go, okay, I got named this. And I've got to come up with a new meaning for this acronym so that I can tell my mom.
Yeah, or, so I can tell my mom what it actually means.
You can't tell them what happened that night in Vegas that got you your call sign.
Yeah,
and sure. I would add to what you said. Yeah, it's most of the time it's due to doing something very stupid. Occasionally, though, it's due to doing something very awesome.
Yeah,
and there was I'll give you an example. We had a crew that was doing night strafe up on Leech Lake there west of Vegas. And so they're number two, number one was two pretty high time instructors. And, they'd done 3 or 4 passes or whatever. And the pilot in number two was getting ready to go into the flight lead upgrade. So they said, hey man, you want to take the tack lead for a couple of the passes here. And yeah, Roger that. Who wouldn't, right? So that he jumps ahead and they go through their first pass. He goes down, it's 25 degrees strafe. So he's downhill, and there are a couple of rules to strafing. And one of those is no switch changes on final.
Yeah.
So the idea there is you're pointed towards the ground at 25 degrees nose low, especially at night. I don't want you fumbling around with switches in the cockpit. I want you focused on the range and the radar altimeter and recovery altitudes, right? Well, this dude, they had forgotten to arm, to go master arm hot. And when he tips in, he gets the reticle on, everything's looking good. And then he realizes it, takes his eyes off of the HUD just for a second, goes down, master arm hot, comes back, and the Wizzo recovers the airplane at 69 feet. Wow. And that's not me trying to say cool guy shit. It was no kidding, 69 feet. And what tipped her off was she had the target latched in the targeting pod, in the infrared pod, and she saw the ground rush coming in the pod. So she reaches down with both hands, rips the top off the stick. They pull 9 G's in the recovery and everything, save both their bacon, dude. And both of them were as white as that wall behind you when they came back in the squadron.
Yeah.
Well, she was up for a naming, and she got named Cherub. So cool guys speak. We refer to thousands of altitude as angels and hundreds of feet of altitude as cherubs. So if you were flying at 20,000 feet, I would say angels to zero for 20,000 feet. Well, cherubs are hundreds of feet. And so she got named Cherub, which kind of fit because she was a dainty little female, flying with us. Yeah. But what a story to go with that name though, huh?
Sorry. Fighting some allergies. Yeah, no doubt, dude. That's crazy.
You're allergic to California. You can go ahead and say it.
I'll tell you. The scariest strafe I ever did was on the Nellis Range. It was at weapons school. And I'm verklempt. No, I'm just, hold on a second.
You need to take a timeout?
No, it's okay. Maybe.
Cass is actively dying right in front of us, guys.
In front of you.
Go find those wings.
I was at weapons school. It was cast phase. It was a night sortie. Low illume, so no moon illumination at all. And there is no cultural lighting on that range. And I'm rolling in to do high angle strafe, 30 degree high angle strafe, 500 foot recovery altitude. And I have a JTAC that's lazing. So he's got an IR pointer that he's pointing on the side of something. I can't even see what it is. So I just set up my base position. I roll down the chute. Did you ever get black hole effect at night?
A little bit, Strike Eagle.
I'm down the chute.
Yep.
And I'm just lining up, the pipper in the HUD with this dude's IR pointer on the ground. And I have no sensation of speed, of altitude, I can't see the ground. Yeah. Even with the goggles on, I couldn't see the ground of it coming up to me or anything like that. I'm just looking in the HUD, watching my cross check so I can get on the trigger when I'm supposed to. It was horrible. Scariest environment.
Yeah, that's crazy. And that's why we talk about cross check being so important.
Yeah. So
keep the eyes moving, keep scanning, because
there's
a similar effect. There's a similar effect up on the North Uter, the North Utah Training and Test Range. Yeah, it's called mirror effect. Have you heard of that one?
Yeah, where it rains out there.
So out west of the target area, the North Uter kind of it's an east-west oriented kind of airspace. So you would start in the west and you'd kind of fly low level and get to the targets in the east. And after a little bit of rain, the way that it mixed with that salt sand that's out there, it looked just like a mirror, man. And with a good blue sky background, you couldn't tell which end was up. It was like instrument flying in the middle of the day. It was crazy. Yeah,
there's some guys that on low levels have killed themselves on that range just because of that.
Yeah.
they start throat reacting and they lose which way's up and they pull the wrong direction and ride it in.
We did a few of those runs. We would go down there and do our readiness inspections, our ORIs. And so we got to where we would do a few of those runs and we would just do it on terrain following radar. We just do TF letdowns and fly the TF all the way in. Cause at least that would keep us safe.
Yeah.
And kind of eliminate that one variable and let us focus on something else. So I want to go back just for a second though, dude. So we were talking about the naming and some of the really unique things that go on at the naming. But the naming always starts with a roll call.
Yeah,
and
sure does.
these are events that are they're unique to the squadron that you're in, but the processes are somewhat similar. I mean, you could go to Nellis right now and probably jump into a roll call and see a lot of similarity between any roll call that you've ever been.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, you know, on a designated date, on a designated time, thou shalt be in the bar.
Yeah.
And if thou aren't in the bar, then you're fined.
Yeah,
sorry.
You're assessed.
And yeah, the mayor stands up there and he's got a list of everybody that's supposed to be there, all the way from the wing commander down to the lowest level lieutenant. And he starts calling the roll. And if you ain't there, you're getting assessed, man.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, roll call.
There's a lot of really cool stuff mixed in there, mixed in with the roll call and different portions of the roll call. There may be a squadron history where you get a young lieutenant to come up there and give some cool history of the squadron. And, you know, some of that's, again, 10% rule maybe applies into that.
Yeah, unless they get booed out, which they usually do.
Yeah, you can get booed off stage for sure,
yes,
100%.
Really
I've starred in that show a couple of times. there's always story time, you know, good stories, not so good stories, which could lead to good names down the road. You got to be careful about, you know, like lieutenant on lieutenant fratricide.
Yes.
in a roll call.
Yeah.
Don't tell stories on your very close bros if you're going through an upgrade or something like that.
Yeah, you sure do. That's a good way to have to take a shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all somebody's got to do is yell out frat and you're kind of screwed. And then there's the fighter pilot song, portion of it where we all kind of get together around, you know, the song of the day or whatever. And somebody, the choir director, will get up there and kind of lead the squadron through the song. And hopefully it's a song that everybody knows.
Yeah.
I have seen it where the guy up there, the maestro, if you will, is the only one who knows what the song is.
Oh,
and it's still entertaining.
Because
yeah, well, he puts on a good show. So you're just there to laugh and have fun. And Instant Justice was always a favorite. That's
awesome.
Where you got to, you get to kind of pick on the different base agencies, or, you know, throw the wing commander under the bus for not driving his placard on or something, you know, something weird.
Yep.
So those were always a good time. Roll calls are always fun.
Good. Roll calls were fun.
Yeah. Part of the roll call kind of ceremony, if you will, I guess, is I'm sure that people have heard of the RMO challenge. This is not unique to the Air Force necessarily, or unique to fighter pilots, but we did partake in that tradition, and you see firefighters doing it.
So
special
RMO,
operators, tier one guys.
Let's
like,
explain what RMO
yeah.
is, right? So RMO
yeah, yeah, go
is round metallic object. And we say RMO because you're not allowed to call it a coin. Cause if you say coin, then basically what you're doing is if you're talking to one of your bros and you say coin, you're basically asking him at that point to show you if he has his RMO on him or not. And if he does, you owe him a drink. So that's how that challenge kind of goes. So every squadron, you carry your RMO with you. I always carried it in my flight suit pocket.
Yep.
Every day, every time everywhere we went, it was always on me.
Yep.
So if I
had
ever
it in my left breast pocket at all times.
Yep.
In fact, when I went up, you know, when we did four letter F words, we were telling the story of my really good bro that took his life. And I went up to Iowa to his funeral. And it was kind of like a mini roll call. I mean, we had, gosh, there was probably 15 dudes there around. And at some point in the night, you hear this tapping on the bar, and everybody was fishing through their pockets to find their RMOs. So we all came armed, and it ended up being a good laugh. But yeah, so the deal behind it, and again, this isn't necessarily Air Force specific, but if I challenge you, if I sit there and I tap my RMO, or if I ask you if you have yours and I present mine, if you don't have yours, then you owe a round of beers.
Yep.
Or a round of drinks.
Yeah, you gotta
if
buy
you
for
do
everybody.
Have yours, then I owe the round.
That's right.
So cautiously challenge someone.
Yeah, you have to be careful
with the RMO.
You have to be smart with
it. And along the lines of things you can and can't say, you said RMO. We don't use the word coin. We use the word RMO. What are some other examples of things that fighter pilots just don't say or do say?
Well, we say container. Cause you're not allowed to
as
say
opposed to
box.
Can't say box.
And you say cranium because you can't say head.
Head? Who said head?
I'll take some of that. yeah. So there's all kinds of funny traditions. And again, I think we talked about this on one of the podcasts, and it may seem childish to some folks out there, but I mean, what you're really doing, and I think you said this on one of our previous podcasts, by having some of these little pieces in there about it teaches guys to actually think about what they're going to fucking say before they just start blabbing words out of their mouth, right? It puts you in this heightened sense of, you know, awareness and just paying attention. It's the attention to detail piece. It's a fun cultural way to reinforce that importance of attention to detail in everything you're doing.
Yeah, it is. You know, we talk about, I mean, on every episode, just about, we've talked about self-awareness and, you know, being mindful of your total person, really, and your mind, body, soul, and your actions, and part of that is your words.
Yeah.
And, you know, not only, I mean, let's just take this be one, change one deep for a second. You know, when you're communicating with your spouse, significant other, with your teammates at work, whatever, you need to be mindful of the words that you choose, because words are like bullets from a gun. Once they're out there, you can't take them back. And I think we talked about it earlier on a different show where we were talking about forgiveness versus forgetting and things like that. But, you know, and when you get to specifically what we're talking about in the, you know, when you're in a cockpit and you're going 500 miles an hour in a robust air-to-air fight with 200 airplanes and you key the mic, it's a push to talk, not a push to think. You have to know exactly what you're saying when you're going to key the mic, because if you don't, you're going to comm jam the rest of the train and the words aren't going to get communicated correctly. Something's going to happen, you know. So it is actually kind of important.
Yeah, it is. So here's something interesting on the RMO piece. I didn't know this, but it says that, do you know how that started? It evidently started in World War II. So there was, I guess there was a wealthy Ivy League lieutenant who had a set of solid bronze coins made for a bunch of his flight mates in the squadron he was in, and he handed them out to everybody. And one of the guys carried it with him all the time, and he ends up getting shot down, picked up by the Germans, ends up interred. The camp that he's in is getting bombed one night. He gets out and evades. He gets picked up by the French Legion. They think they don't believe that he's like an American fighter pilot. They think he's like some kind of a German saboteur or something like that, right? Because he didn't have any, he'd been in that POW camp. He didn't have any identification on him. You know, he's wearing whatever they gave him in the POW camp to wear, pajamas, you know, and all this stuff. But he had hidden the coin. He found a way to hide the coin. I don't know how, and I don't want to know how, but he hid the coin.
Oh, reference Pulp Fiction. Yeah. I know how he hid it.
And so they were gonna kill this guy, the French war, and he showed one of the guys the coin, and the guy recognized the insignia on it as one of the squadrons, one of the Air Force squadrons. And so
that's cool, man.
They saved his life, and they spared his life and ended up getting him back to the Americans eventually. So that's, I guess, where it comes from.
Yeah. So when our podcast makes it Rogan big, we'll get some B1 change one RMOs.
Yeah, that'd be
and
cool.
Start passing them out to people in the community.
Yeah.
And then we can challenge everybody up and down the list.
That'd be fun. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Cause we got all about 25 followers now. So yeah.
Any day now.
That's 25 beers potentially, man.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm telling you.
It's at least one free drink.
Somebody needs to give Rogan a heads up, man.
I'm telling you, brother. Let's go.
It's coming. Yeah. All right. Roll calls. RMOs. Things you can and can't say. Breaking wings. And then one day, dude, you're taxiing in on your last flight.
Oh, yeah.
Your Finny flight.
Yep.
What was that experience like? Like, I mean, just from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you change into your fresh flight suit after it's all over with.
Yeah.
That whole day to me was kind of a thing. That's a significant emotional event.
Yeah. And it was everywhere too, right? Cause you do it at every base that you leave, and it's kind of the culmination for me. It always just was such a great way to signify kind of like the culmination of, because like even after leaving Korea and getting to Shaw, you know, like saying goodbye to Korea was, I had a great time there, man. I mean, I learned a lot. I grew up a lot as a punk, in Korea. I had a lot of great instructors in Korea. I'd learned how to get very tactical and lethal. And then when I got to Shaw, you know, I went through the flight lead upgrade programs and my instructor pilot. So there's like all these different places you go. There's like these benchmarks that you accomplished when you're there. And it's just kind of a cool way of, you know, wrapping all that up and signifying like everything that you were able to do and accomplish with the squadron and with your bros and individually over the time that you were there. So, and they're pretty standard across the board, I think. Right. So you get in, I mean, I would always try the rule is basically like the punks will always be at the bottom of the ladder and they're going to try to get you down, you know, and if you got kids or something, they've got the fire hydrants and or the water bottles getting ready to spray you down. And basically what happens is when you get out of the jet,
super soakers or something,
there's a little bit of a wrestling match that typically goes on until you start to get older and then you just accept your fate. But, you know, the punks will get you down on the ground. They'll duct tape your hands and your legs together. Every once in a while, we'd hang a guy if he wasn't too heavy on, you know, an MRL or something to suspend him. And then family's hosing him down. And then once you get him down and get the duct tape off his hands and feet, then there's a bottle of champagne waiting, you know, and guys uncork it and then they start drinking and passing it around. Everybody comes up, says their thank yous and farewells, and it's just badass. When I was younger, I always tried to get away. I had a great trick. Kind of great trick in the F-16, man. Because if you can
jump off the right wing.
Just go off the right side. And so I'd get my G suit and everything undone, and all the punks would be down at the bottom of the ladder, and I'd hand somebody my helmet bag because obviously I don't want to hurt my hammocks. And then I'm taking all my stuff off, and then when I would grab it, I would basically throw it down at them, and they'd all kind of scatter, and then I'd go out the right side of the airplane and start running.
Yeah, right on.
So
right on. Yeah, Strike Eagle's a little tall to be jumping out of cockpits.
It's a little taller.
It's a little tall to be jumping off of wings, but you could shimmy down. If we had wing tanks on, you could shimmy down the wing tank and kind of get away that way. But at risk of broken limb, like for real.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, as we got older, you know, I mean, I retired, I was over 40 when I retired. Not a lot of duct tape, not a lot of wrestling going on there. It was get hosed down by the fire hydrants. You know, my wife poured a bottle of freezing cold champagne over my head. Yep. And then the game begins. Okay, now I'm going to chase you all down and give you this great big hug now that I'm soaking wet covered in champagne. Like champagne. You are too.
Everybody in the squadron smells like champagne for the rest of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yep. So. Kind of just some unwritten rules is always have a fresh flight suit in your locker just in case.
Yep.
But yeah, that Finney flight, man, I remember, you know, you go through them through the various squadrons as you're transitioning through your career and whatnot. But that last one, like, you know, after today, you're never going to put that G suit on again. Mm-hmm. You're never going to put that helmet on again. And so that whole day was had a little bit of a cloud over it.
Yeah,
for sure. And you kind of spend a lot of time like in the briefing. I remember from mine, you know, when we all sat down to brief it up, it was, you just sit down and tell stories, man. Yeah. You kind of reminisce, you get through the required portions of the brief to make us quote unquote legal to fly. But it was really just, you know, reminiscing and bringing back some of those memories and telling stories and just fun. Really trying to relive and recreate some of those moments.
Yeah. It goes by so fast, man. Yeah. It's a very surreal day. The last one, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's
that was challenging.
Yeah.
But you know what? There's a lesson to be had there, man. And while, you know, you and I got to live some of that firsthand, maybe a lot of our listeners either aren't there yet or they've chosen a different path in life, and that's fine. But, you know, if I had a message to send to them, I would say that, man, enjoy the little moments, man. And I was reading this book a while back by John Huntsman, and I circled this quote in there, and it says, "You only have a moment to enjoy this moment." Yeah. And God darn, it took me a long time to be able to just slow down and enjoy where your feet are, man. Yeah. Be where you're planted.
It did me too, man. I mean, that's, if I have a regret at all, it's that, especially when I was younger and just coming up in the Air Force, that I didn't recognize that. I was always so future focused.
Yeah.
I was always so focused on what do I need to be doing to get better? What do I need to do to execute better? You know, getting in the vault, or what's the next upgrade I got to tackle? Like, I was always so future focused that I had a really hard time just enjoying being in the moment of some of those things. And
yeah,
and I wish I would have had more self-awareness around that back then.
It's hard to tell a young person though, who's leaning so far forward, because you know, you're trying to make a name for yourself. You're trying to create your reputation. You're trying to create your own path and write your own narrative. And it's so difficult to just, I mean, I have to do it with my kids every now and then. It's just like, dude, just slow down, man. These are opportunities that you'll never, ever get to recreate. You can't recreate some of these moments. And once it's gone, man, it's just a memory.
That's right.
So take a second.
Yeah, you do.
Let that soak in, man. As you're taxiing in for that last flight, you know, taxi a little slower and look around and really just, you know, really savor the smell of the mask and, you know, the different sensations that you're having. Cause I was coaching a football game one time and it was a championship game and we were going to win the game. Like, I think there's like 2 minutes left or something and we're up 32-12. We're going to win. And I called my last time out. I got my whole team around me and I said, guys, I didn't need to talk to you. I want everybody to just stop for a second, look up in the stands, find your mom and dad, wave to them, look at the scoreboard, burn this memory into your brain, dude. Take a few seconds here until the referee blows the whistle and just enjoy this moment.
Yeah.
Because once it's over, it's gone.
Yeah.
And we did, man. All of us sat there. I mean, there was, 25 people on the team at the time. And then all the coaches, we just kind of sat there and just looked around the stadium and really enjoyed the sights and sounds and smells of what was happening right then in that moment. And I'm so glad that I did that.
Yeah, because, that's super cool.
I mean, I go back to that memory so often. It was freezing cold. It smelled like crap because we were down in Buckeye and the cow shit was blowing our direction. And I mean, it was just a really surreal moment to be able to pause. And I'm so thankful that I had the SA to do that in that moment.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. And that's a great lesson too, because it is. I mean, you only get so many of those moments in life. You know what I mean? And you need to be able to appreciate them while you're experiencing them. So. Yeah, I was never very good at that.
They're fleeting, man.
They are.
Yeah, I think we all suck at it from time to time and some more than others. But I'd like to think that maybe in my old age, I've become aware enough of my surroundings and of the different goings on in the day where I can recognize some of those moments a little bit better. And recently, I've screwed that up within the last couple of years. But different story for another day.
Well, what else you got, brother?
Any other big traditions you want to talk about, man?
I mean, we could go on and on, man, but there's, you know, dining ins and dining outs and grogs and all that stuff but we can do that another time.
Yeah, sure. I really want to get down into my pet peeves of flying commercial airlines.
Oh yeah, let's do that
at some point too, but not my traditions, but definitely got my blood pressure up the other day. So I've got a list going. Katie suggested that maybe we do that for one of our first name Fridays. We put it out there and get a list from people on, you know, what are your pet peeves of just being out in society? Yeah. Like, as I'm talking to Katie about this afternoon, I'm walking out of the Walmart and there's a gaggle of ladies walking in the exit of the Walmart. And I'm like, really? It's like when the elevator doors open and everybody tries to bum rush into the elevator before people come out of the elevator.
I love that.
Come on, guys.
That all the time.
Let's have a little civility about us. You know,
flying.
There are rules to life.
Yeah, I get back into Phoenix and the SkyTrain pulls up and it's full of people trying to get off to the terminal and people just go trying to get in and get on right through all the people. And it's like,
yeah,
can you just put it on pause for like 20 seconds and let them get out? It'd go much easier if we did that.
Well, I'm not a small guy. I mean, I'm not huge or anything, but I'm not a small guy and I will chicken wing and make myself as big and blown up as I can. And I will make it very painful for those people trying to wiggle their way on before I get off. Motherfucker, I have the right of way.
Yeah, you do. Here, I agree with you.
Anyways, that'll be a fun discussion at some point because we all have them and everybody's going to have a little bit of an individual take on some of those things. That'll be a fun discussion. We should get the wives together and do that. That'd be a fun one to have them. Yeah. All right. I got no other traditions I wanted to talk about,
that's
man.
That's it for me.
Party shots.
Be the one.
Be the change.